The immigration problem. It's not just in the U.S.
It's just a matter of time when Athens and the centers of migration will be saturated.
The international flood of immigrants and what's left of the American dream. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. When we talk about illegal immigration, we in the U.S. tend to forget that other countries also face that challenge. It's a crisis in Greece. Part of the backlash against a flood of immigrants from war-torn countries is the growing popularity of the Golden Dawn Party. They're extreme right. They call themselves nationalist and racist. A third of their leaders are in jail, charged with murder, extortion, and arson. Despite that, Golden Dawn politicians are likely to be voted into the European Parliament amid high approval ratings. Greece is overwhelmed with people from Iraq and Afghanistan entering the country from Turkey. And despite EU funding to help control the surge of illegal immigrants, the numbers are swelling. Sarah Elzis visited Samos, one of the hundreds of small Greek islands in the eastern Aegean. Its sleepy capital of 12,000 people only saw foreigners coming off cruise ships and tourist ferries. Now, dozens of illegal immigrants are arrested there every day.
It's 10 p.m. and the Samos Coast Guard is heading out on its nightly patrol. Captain Nektarios Kitsa starts the boat. As it gets up to speed, the three other officers on board scan the dark water using a radar and a thermal camera.
All these lights are Turkey.
One of the officers, Vargelis, points to lights across the water, Turkey. People cross from there to Samos Island in rubber rafts. At their closest point, Turkey and Samos are just 800 meters apart. Immigrants are told by smugglers to slash their boats if they see the Coast Guard to force the patrols to take them in.
If the illegal immigrants cut the boat, our missions change. It's saving the lives at sea. Understand?
From Border Patrol to search and rescue. By mid-November of 2008, the Samos Coast Guard had brought in 48 dead bodies from the water. About 80 people arrive in Samos each day, either brought in by the Coast Guard or landing on the shores on their own. They're arrested by the police, fingerprinted, and screened for tuberculosis and other contagious diseases. Then they're put into detention. The Samos Detention Center is built to house 350 people. These days, they're regularly twice that many. The center is at the end of a winding road in the hills overlooking Samos town. The day I visited, the sun was setting a brilliant orange over the port below, making the center's red-roofed boxy buildings glow. They're surrounded by chain-link fencing topped with razor wire. An announcement in Arabic calls people to the dining area for a Greek lesson. Two volunteers have come up from town to teach the class. Mothers show up with children as young as 2 years old. Teenage boys come in, too, eager to talk about getting out, like this kid who says he's 15 and from Afghanistan. He's been here for 18 days.
We said too many times to them, leave us from here, we will leave this country, we will go any other country. There is no school. We are eating and going, sleeping, eat and sleep, eat and sleep. Yes, I think it's not alive.
He and the two boys with him asked me to adopt them, take them home with me. Most people in the detention center are typical of those coming to Greece these days, young men from Afghanistan and other war and conflict-torn countries like Iraq and Somalia. Samos Vice Prefect Tanos Stylianidis says the island has spent almost half of its operating budget on screening, housing, and feeding these immigrants. But he says immigration to his island isn't just a Greek problem. Few, if any, people here are aiming for Greece. They're trying to access Sweden, Denmark, or the UK.
It's a problem that...
This is a problem that does not only concern Samos. We are the first receptors, but it is a problem that concerns Greece as a country and the whole European Union. Because Greece or the island cannot sustain them economically, they will try to go to other Central European countries. It's just a matter of time when Athens and the centers of migration will be saturated.
Some would say it already is saturated. From Samos and other outlying islands, most immigrants end up in the capital. In the evenings, Afghans hang out in front of Agios Panteleimonas Church in central Athens. Young men stand around smoking and talking. Women watch children in the playground next door. Some guys are squatting around a tray of hard-boiled eggs. They hit the eggs against each other and bet on whose will crack first. I've been brought here by Nassim, a 24-year-old Afghan who came to Greece 6 years ago. He has an apartment and a job. He tried to apply for asylum, but ended up with a visa that only gets renewed if he pays Social Security. He works as a carpenter, takes high school night classes. Nassim says most people in the square are homeless. They sleep outside. He says he sometimes takes people home with him.
For example, someone that he is so old or some children, if it's cold, if it's difficult, I take someone with me in my home just for night. At the morning, 5 o'clock, when I get up, I said, come back to the park.
Nassim says people don't understand why they face the same conditions in Europe that they were fleeing from back home.
When they were hungry in Afghanistan, now they are hungry here. They were unsafe in Afghanistan. They didn't have security in Afghanistan. The same, it's happening in Greece, in Europe.
In the church square, everyone talks of wanting to leave Greece.
I want to go to another, here, not work, not give 20 papers. I won't go to another countries.
You want to go to Italy?
How?
We have no money, but we are trying to go.
Most want to leave, but under what's called the Dublin Regulation, if they try to go to another EU country like Italy or France, they can be sent back. Their papers should be processed in the country where they entered. One of the only ways for people in the square to be legalized is to apply for asylum, to be recognized as refugees. About a third of illegal immigrants to Greece end up applying, either when they first arrive or after they've been sent back from another country. But the system is overrun. Alexia Vasiliou of the Greek Council for Refugees says that Athens doesn't have the resources to process so many people.
There's one building, and the staff that they have there are only able to cope with about 350 applications a week. And on average, there are about 2,000 people outside waiting in a line to get in. And that causes all sorts of delays, problems, inconvenience, and sometimes injury or worse.
In fact, last October, an asylum seeker died and several were injured in front of the immigration office in a crush of 3,000 people. Even after the few who are admitted into the office are processed and interviewed, very few end up with a positive response. In 2007, about 25,000 people applied. A total of 8 got asylum on the first try. Even on appeal, fewer than 1% of the applicants were granted asylum. 2008 was marginally better, just under 2%. Greece has the lowest asylum grant rate in the European Union. Some, like Spiros Rizakos, a member of the Group of Lawyers for the Rights of Refugees and Migrants, says it's done on purpose.
You can easily grant refugee status to Afghani people, to Iraqi people, to Somali people, to Sudanese people. But they don't. Greek authorities want to spread the message, don't come to Greece, it's hell. So people finally, eventually, come to the conclusion that they should leave Greece. And that's what the Greek authorities want.
Patroklos Georgiadis, General Secretary of the Ministry of Interior, says the grant rate's low only in terms of percentages.
If a country has to examine 100 applicants and give 2 or 3 people the asylum approval, then we talk about 2 or 3%. In Greece we had, for 2007, 25,000 applicants.
But even other border countries have higher rates. Spain accepted 8% of asylum seekers in 2007, while Italy gave asylum to 10% of its 14,000 applicants. Greece has been accused by rights groups of giving only cursory examinations to asylum claims and rejecting them without any explanation. The United Nations Refugee Agency has deemed the situation so bad that it's called on other European countries not to return people to Greece and instead process their applications themselves. Back in Samos with the Coast Guard Patrol, it's way after midnight. Rain has started coming down in sheets. We've been out for 5 hours and we haven't found anyone.
So it's 3 o'clock and we haven't seen anything. What do you think is going on?
Bad weather.
So nobody's coming?
Nobody's coming because afraid for the sunk of the boat. Yeah. Maybe they will try later or tomorrow.
And yet this is, for you, this is a good thing?
Of course. No illegal immigrants, better for us.
On a clear night, they usually bring in at least one boatload of 20 to 30 people. As we headed back to port, the captain told me I'd brought them good luck. Not everyone gets picked up by the Coast Guard, though. Some land on their own and make their way into town.
We see people walking around, especially in the morning, because they usually arrive late at night, early, very early in the morning.
Maria is a member of the volunteer-run Samos Solidarity Committee that tries to help refugees on the island through clothing drives, Greek lessons, whatever they can do.
They land on the beach and they walk until they find a village. They ask where the police is. They do not know where they are. They know they are in Greece, but they don't know if they are in Samos or in another island.
They eventually find the police station, which sends them to the detention center. After a few weeks in detention, most are released and head to the capital. And afterwards, if they don't manage to ask for asylum or find another solution to stay in Greece, they're given a deportation order.
The paper says in 30 days you have to leave Greece.
Kostas Pasayanis is a lawyer who helps immigrants apply for asylum in Samos. Greece, he says, doesn't have the resources to deport people.
It is auto-deportation. With this paper, you can't go to buy a ticket, okay? You have to leave Greece illegally, as you came.
But getting out is as difficult, if not more, than getting in. So they stay, which strains the government's already stretched resources even more, causing more delays, more problems. The Greek government has taken small steps over the last few months. They've introduced a subsidiary humanitarian protection, their moves to process asylum on the islands. But it's likely to be too little, because people just keep coming.
You cannot stop them. You cannot build walls in the waters. And you cannot stop them because they don't live well where they are. They believe they come here to find a new and peaceful life.
In Samos, Greece, I'm Sarah Elsis.
Coming up, Sweden looks for a humanist answer to the immigration problem. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1298. When it comes to embracing refugees, Sweden is known to be among the friendliest countries in the European Union. Even more so after the Swedish Migration Board announced in September of 2013 that every Syrian who goes straight to Sweden can get a permanent residence permit. Over 20,000 Syrians applied for refugee status in Sweden in 2013, and the vast majority of them are expected to receive asylum. The problem is getting all the way to Sweden. Thousands have died trying to sneak into the EU, and their situation made headlines in October when a boat full of migrants sank and 366 refugees drowned in the Mediterranean Sea outside of Italy. Now, for the first time in decades, several Swedish politicians are publicly demanding that refugees be given legal and safe avenues to seek asylum in Sweden and other EU countries. Christopher Holmbeck and Julia Lundberg have more.
Kais Badro arrives at 10 each morning to one of the few shops in Ekshärad, a small village in the middle of Sweden. A Syrian refugee, Kais spends his days at a local Red Cross-supported shop to guide newcomers, mostly from Syria, in their asylum cases. He says that he's full of gratitude.
When I look these people here in Swedish, what they do for me, I forget everything what happened with me.
To come to Sweden and seek asylum, you need to put your life in the hands of strangers. You need thousands of dollars, and you need luck. Kais and his family first fled to Turkey and arrived there with very little to their name.
In Turkey, we have hard life. I have 4 children, and they no have paper, they no have nothing, they can't go to school. I can't find work because I no have ID card, I no have anything.
After 5 months in Turkey, Kais paid $15,000 for a false passport and a trip to Sweden. He could not afford to bring his family, so made the tough decision to leave them behind.
I think about the future, because we don't know when they finish this problem in Syria.
Kais was in constant fear when he was smuggled by strangers through Europe. Then, when he finally arrived in Ekshärad, he soon learned that the 3-year residence permit he got did not allow his family to reunite with him in Sweden. Sanna Westin is the chairman of FAR, a Swedish grassroots network of refugee support groups, and she says many Syrians, until recently, were faced with tough choices.
Very many Syrians got here, got a permit, and then realized, oh, my family can't come. I have my children in some misery in a camp somewhere, or still in the war. And what shall I do? Shall I go home to the war again and lose this permit? It was a really awful situation for many Syrians.
So Vestin was relieved last September when the Swedish Migration Board dropped the three-year limit. Now every Syrian refugee that has made it to Sweden can receive a permanent residence permit, which under Swedish law enables Kais and other Syrians to legally bring their close family members to Sweden. This has made Sweden the only European country to adopt this policy, and reporters from around the world have been calling Vestin to ask her about what they call Sweden's open door policy. She says that she refuses to answer their questions.
I mean, it's still forbidden to travel to Sweden to seek asylum. It's not an open door, it's a very closed door. There is only one way to get here, and this is by breaking the law in some way. You have to rely on human smugglers, which is very dangerous. You have to go by these horrible boat trips. This is criminalizing people. You have to make yourself a criminal just to get in here.
Most Syrians trying to reach the EU travel across the Mediterranean on hazardous, shabby and overcrowded boats. The price for the boat ride is about half of what Kais paid to fly into Europe with a false passport. But even if they're lucky enough to make it across the sea, they must avoid being fingerprinted in another EU country. Otherwise, Swedish migration and border authorities can send them back to where they were fingerprinted, and that country, not Sweden, will process their claim to refugee status. Swedish authorities have used this possibility to refuse over 1,500 asylum seekers from Syria during the last year.
The next station is Copenhagen Airport.
Meanwhile, legal citizens of the European Union cross borders daily without notice. We reached the Copenhagen Airport in Denmark, a 30-minute train trip from Lund University in the south of Sweden, where Gregor Nall is a professor of international law. In a matter of hours, he will have crossed several borders. Noll points out the hypocrisy of a word that is often used to describe Swedish migration politics, generosity.
What Sweden does is essentially the same as the US or any industrialized state does that receives refugees, asylees. It protects the borders of its nation state. It maintains very high walls around the nation state, to speak metaphorically. And once people nonetheless manage to get over these walls and actually access our territories, we congratulate ourselves on our generosity. There's obviously something wrong in that line of thinking.
Still, he says that when 366 African refugees drowned at sea trying to reach Italy in October 2013, it not only drew worldwide media attention, but also prompted a serious political debate in Sweden.
There was a sense in media reporting that this is not just, this is not fair. It was so clear that people would be sacrificed at sea for the integrity of our borders.
Ultimately, this tragedy caused some Swedish politicians to think twice about the country's current refugee laws. Now, for the first time, several representatives within the established political parties are talking publicly about creating legal routes into the European Union, a move that would set a precedent in the region. But the question remains, will this debate lead to actual policy changes?
It would really need a state like Sweden saying, okay, now we're putting together our historical traditions connected with the name of Raoul Wallenberg. With this crisis, we're throwing our weight behind it. We are not playing the kind of diplomatic softball anymore. We are now taking a unilateral initiative. I think it would be needed.
But the two big parties in Sweden are staunch opponents to such reforms. And neither Gregor Nall nor Sanna Vestin think that Sweden or any other European government will create legal ways to enter and seek asylum in the EU in the near future. Back in the small shop in the village of Ekshärad, Kais Badro is helping a family to find some clothes and furniture. The family has recently received permanent residence permits in Sweden, and in a few hours they will move to their own place in a neighboring city.
They, you know, they before they move, they come, they look if we can found something day before to move for a new apartment. And they, he say they need some lamp because that's apartment they don't have.
While the process for this family has been swift, Kais is still waiting for his permanent residence permit and for his family to then be able to travel here and reunite with him. The process takes months for some and years for others. Kais is frustrated, but happy that he will see his family eventually.
If I give Swedish all my life, I think that's not enough. Because they do everything good for us.
Still, he says, it would be better for Syrians if there were legal ways to come to Sweden.
And it will be easy for him. They don't need to pay this money, black money for people, and they don't need to be difficult for children or women. I think it will be better if they do something like that.
For Making Contact, I'm Christopher Holmback with Julia Lundberg, reporting from Sweden.
America was once known as the land where the streets were paved with gold. That promise, a chance to succeed, lured millions of refugees, and those new Americans helped define this country. They were all hoping to achieve the American dream. All that was needed was hard work. Times have changed. But new research shows that opportunity in America hasn't changed much in a long, long time. State of Opportunity's Dustin Dwyer of Michigan Public Radio looks at what that research might tell us about creating more economic opportunity.
10 years ago, the number of censuses for which you could do this was more limited.
Joseph Ferry is an economist at Northwestern University. He's used old census forms as a way to gather economic information about families. In recent years, these forms have become searchable online, thanks to the rise of genealogy websites.
And with the passing years, the range of things that you could do expands dramatically.
Like compare economic outcomes across generations at different points in time. These outcomes, which most of us think of as opportunity or the American dream, scientists call social mobility. Ferry and a co-author compared the rates of social mobility in the U.S. in the 19th and 20th centuries with Britain at the same time.
We've looked at comparisons between the U.S. and Britain in the 19th century, and the U.S. is vastly more mobile across generations. By the 20th century, those differences are completely erased.
One possible explanation why the U.S. might have had more social mobility in, say, 1850 is that it was in the middle of the Industrial Revolution. In Great Britain, the change to an industrial economy happened earlier. But among many researchers, the surprising part of Ferry's finding wasn't that the U.S. had less opportunity in the 20th century. It's that there was ever any difference at all. A growing body of research, published just in the past 2 years, shows remarkably little change in opportunity across countries and across time. A team that includes researchers from both Harvard and Berkeley reached a similar conclusion when they looked at tax return data in the United States over the past 4 decades. In a paper published earlier this year, the team said a child born in 1971 had the same chance of moving up the economic ladder in America as a child born in 1986. Consider how much social change has happened in the past half century. The war on poverty, the rise of the digital economy. If you consider Ferry's research, you can go back as far as the New Deal and not see much change in opportunity across generations. To Ferry, that doesn't mean it's not worth trying to improve opportunity.
It just means that the effort we'll have to put into it may be a great deal more substantial than anyone imagined.
For policymakers interested in improving opportunity, the message seems to be, go big or go home. With State of Opportunity, I'm Dustin Dwyer, Michigan Radio News.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. If you'd like to hear the show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. This week's show is number 1298. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.